Hello, everybody. This is Scott Yates, Director of Communications and Producer Relations for the Washington Grain Commission, here with episode 192 of Wheat All About It, or what I entitled Wheat's Early Years in Washington, about my absorbing conversation with Jim Kirshner, an historic researcher and former reporter and columnist for Spokane's Spokesman Review newspaper. I don't know Kirshner personally, but I know of him through the articles he wrote for the newspaper during a long career. Today, as part of what keeps him busy, is writing a 100 Years Ago Today column for the newspaper. If you ever doubt we're making progress as a society, I believe his accounts mostly confirm we are. As I was producing this podcast, I checked Kirshner's column, and appropriately enough, the August 17, 2020 entry was about a smut explosion in a threshing machine near Walla Walla that occurred on August 17, 1920. The long-ago article called the event one of the frightening dangers of harvesting, which occurs when spores from wheat smut diseases clog the thresher, which then explodes when static electricity supplies the spark. What a difference 100 years makes, huh? Not only are standalone threshers a thing of the past, thanks to chemical seed treatments, we don't have much, if any, smut diseases either. I've always enjoyed reading about the past because it reminds me that a lifetime often isn't enough for us to see the progress of humanity. By reading books and articles about how things were in the past, however, we are lifted out of our present to view a landscape of progress that is otherwise difficult to perceive. Recently, a portion of an essay that Kirshner wrote on early wheat farming in Washington was included in the July 2020 issue of Wheat Life. The larger story was about the innovative effort to look back at the state's early agriculture that's being helmed by the organization HistoryLink. I called Kirshner to ask if he would elaborate on his essay for a podcast, and he graciously agreed. But I had an ulterior motive. When I started at the Grain Commission more than 13 years ago, I inherited a publication called Wheat Facts. One of those facts was that the first wheat was grown in Washington at Fort Vancouver and was planted by the Lewis and Clark Expedition. Although I changed Wheat Facts substantially over the years and always verified anything new, I never questioned the Lewis and Clark fact. Long story short, I should have. Kirshner pointed out that among other things that make the Lewis and Clark connection untrue was the absence of a Fort Vancouver at the time of their travels, not to mention the expedition wintered in Astoria, and they started their return trip as soon as possible in the spring, not leaving enough time to plant and harvest a crop, even if they had the seed, which Kirshner says they didn't. Darn. It turns out the Hudson Bay Company, a Canadian outfit which still has department stores in Canada, is responsible for planting the first wheat crops in Washington. In the interest of setting everyone straight, I ask Kirshner to tell me more.
The Hudson Bay Company was the main fur trading company throughout the West and the Northwest. And it was Canada-based, but in that era, there was no border between Canada and the U.S. It was all just one big, vast, unexplored territory. And the reason that it's important for wheat is just that they had several outposts. When they traded furs, they had to have trading posts where Native Americans and fur trappers could come in and, you know, trade their beaver pelts for whatever else they needed. And so one was at Fort Vancouver, which is today's Vancouver, Washington. And that was one of the earliest ones. And that was the one, as far as I can tell, as a historical researcher, was the first wheat that was planted in our, in the state and in our region, for the very good reason that there was no other settlement, really. This was in the 1820s and 1830s. It was long after Lewis and Clark, but way before any other settlements. The guy who ran that trading post, George Simpson, when he first traveled through the eastern central Washington, and he immediately said, you know what, this would be great country for wheat. It's too bad nobody's ever tried it. And when he got to Fort Vancouver, then he tried it, and he grew a whole bunch of wheat. I mean, mainly for their own use, you know, the use of the trading post. And then there was another Hudson Bay trading post at what is today Colville in eastern Washington. So they planted wheat there too. So that qualifies as the first wheat in eastern Washington. And you know, these were just really isolated settlements that were trying to grow their own food, essentially. The wheat in Fort Vancouver, I know that by 1833 they were harvesting 3,000 bushels a year. And in 1827, Fort Colville near Kettle Falls was reaping 200 bushels of wheat and barley. So very, very early, those settlements were really the only European settlements in the region at the time.
Was wheat a hit from the get-go in this region?
Yes. One reason that George Simpson, Sir George Simpson, the Hudson Bay guy, was so excited about it was he was convinced that it was perfect conditions for wheat. And that turned out to be pretty accurate. I mean, there's a lot of ins and outs of it. I mean, he was growing wheat on the west side of the state, which, of course, as we know today, there's still wheat, plenty of wheat grown on the west side of the state. But it's different conditions, really, than the east side of the state, east of the Cascades. At first, they were really successful, especially with the English varieties of wheat, which are more adapted to a more maritime, you know, cooler and wetter climate. So it's perfect for the west side of the state. And then later, as people began to settle the central and eastern parts of Washington and realized that everywhere that there was bunch grass is the native grass that is the most common, you know, huge pasture prairies of bunch grass and hills full of bunch grass. They realized pretty early that any place that could grow bunch grass could also grow wheat. But it took them a while, and obviously they experimented with different strains and found other strains that were more suited to a little bit drier non-maritime climate. And Walla Walla being the first place in what we now think of as wheat country.
Tell me about Walla Walla's role in early Eastern Washington wheat enterprises.
Well, it was the Whitman Mission. The Whitmans came to Walla Walla in 1836, and they brought a jar of seed wheat with them, and they planted it, and it just did really, really well. I mean, everybody was just sort of amazed at how well it did. I mean, they were down in the river valleys, in the Walla Walla and Touchet valleys of east central Washington. And it just turned out to be really good, wonderful conditions for it. And they were milling their own flour by 1841 in Walla Walla. And that was really where wheat growing sort of spread in eastern Washington and central Washington. So at first, they started harvesting it in the river bottoms near Waitsburg and Walla Walla and other towns around Walla Walla. This is very early. This is in the 1860s. This was those places began to be settled by European settlers right after the Indian Wars ended in 1856. So people started pouring in there over the Oregon Trail, and they started planting wheat, and they just turned out to be a fantastic place. And they had Walla Walla had five flour mills in operation in 1864. And they had more than they could. This was certainly not just, they had way more than they needed for local consumption. So they were sending it to the gold fields in Montana and west to Portland to, you know, to be loaded on ships and sold elsewhere.
Now, Jim, I have read quotes from USDA officials who considered all of Eastern Washington a veritable desert. How was it that there is such diametrically opposed viewpoints of the agronomic potential of Eastern Washington?
You know, this was all trial and error. They would just they would plant it and see how it did. And it turned out it just did really, really well in a, you know, sort of a belt from Walla Walla up through the Palouse. Then there was other parts of Eastern Washington where it did well, but not, but it, they realized that they couldn't plant a crop every year. They had to let it lie fallow every other year.
You use the phrase in one of your essays, quoting others, that the land was impossibly arid and couldn't support wheat, and yet the impossibly arid line kept moving. And of course, you have described what happened, but it's just amazing to me to think about the word impossibly arid not being particularly accurate.
Yeah, they just, I mean, it looked brown, it looked dry, that a lot of that land. But as they experimented with it, they realized that it really wasn't as dry and arid as they thought. They would try different strains of wheat, and they found some that worked. And so that line, that possibly arid line, just kept getting pushed farther and farther.
Jim, what sort of plants are indigenous to Eastern Washington? Was there anything that the Native Americans could eat?
Oh, yeah. I mean, they had an entire, you know, spectrum of plants that they ate. Not grains, though.
In your research, have you come across comments about the difficulties of farming here? What challenges did farmers face in the early pioneering days?
The biggest challenge, right, in the earliest days was getting the crop to market. I mean, there were no railroads yet, and that was harder than harvesting the crop, really. Growing and harvesting it was the easy part. Getting it to the seaboard, meaning, you know, Seattle, Portland, to get it to market. If you were a wheat farmer in the Walla Walla or Columbia Valley, or, you know, what was now the Tri-Cities, or anywhere in there, you had to haul your entire harvest by wagon to the Columbia River in order to get it on a boat to take it down to a port. That was a really, really daunting task, to an entire wheat harvest by wagon. So when the railroads arrived, and this is more like the 1880s, finally the railroads arrived, and one of the reasons the railroads came was to get help. I mean, this was one of the incentives to get railroads here, was to get those crops to market. So after the railroads arrived, it became a lot easier.
Okay. Well, one of the difficulties that you wrote about was a plague of ground squirrels, and that there was even a contest with school children to kill ground squirrels.
In that era, they were real problem. They would gobble up the entire, every shoot you planted. And so this is one of the main tasks of the county extension agent back in the day. And we're talking, you know, late 1800s and early 1900s, is exterminating those ground squirrels and rabbits too, jackrabbits, because they would destroy a crop. And I think it's hilarious. I came across several items where they were holding, that elementary school children would compete to see which class could poison the most ground squirrels.
Not something we do in elementary schools today.
No, can you imagine? Can you imagine that? Yeah, sending the little elementary kids out with cyanide or whatever they had. Yeah.
So Jim, I find it fascinating that the Palouse was not initially a place where wheat farming caught on. Was there other sorts of agriculture going on in the Palouse before wheat?
They were kind of struggling to find the right crop. And there was a lot of, you know, cattle and sheep and hay it's, you know, down in the bottomlands, at least, hay. So it was, like a lot of eastern and central Washington, it was more ranch country than farm country for at the beginning. But by the 1880s and 90s, they realized that wheat was the thing, and it did exceptionally well. All sorts of conditions just combined to be just about perfect with the, you know, deep wind-blown soil, finely textured soil, highly retentive of moisture, and just the enough rain, you know, just the right amount of rain in a lot of ways. So by the turn of the century, most of the cattle and sheep men had converted to wheat. And I found a statistic, I mean, just in the state in general, in 1896, Washington produced 6 million bushels of wheat. In 1905, this is only 9 years later, they were producing 25 million bushels of wheat, and almost all of it came from the Columbia Plateau, which includes the Palouse.
You wrote about combines being pulled by 32 horses or mules.
The photos of harvest time in that era, 1890s, 1900, up to World War I, are just amazing with these gigantic teams of horses or mules. They weren't always horses pulling these gigantic combines.
And they required really large crews. How many hands would a typical farm have, and how would the crews have been fed at that time?
You had to have a lot of hired hands to run the farm. And so there were some that would be hired hands that, you know, were there year round to help with the farming. But at harvest time, you would hire an average of 20 men on every farm to do the harvest. And of course, these would be our itinerant farm workers who traveled all over the country. What would happen is that they would basically show up by railroad in these little towns that were bigger then, like we're talking towns like Harrington and Lynd, Odessa, towns like that in central and eastern Washington. They were bigger because they had to support a much larger population of people. Anyway, they'd pour into these towns at harvest time, get hired. You know, the farmers would, you know, bid for their services, and they'd come out and spend a week or I don't know how many days on each farm and move from farm to farm. So it was a very different scene, and it was much more sociable, and they'd have big harvest dinners, you know, where everybody'd have this gigantic feast outside, you know, outdoors after the harvest was in, and, you know, big parties in town, big, you know, dances and all sorts of things going on.
When did the conversion from horsepower to machines occur? And when do you imagine the last horse rigs harvested their last crop?
Conversion to mechanization probably began, well, I mean, right around the time that that the automobile showed up, which was around the turn of the century. And then, you know, gradually through the next 10 or 20 years, you know, tractors and combines were invented, and some farmers were able to afford them. And so it was going on through the 1900s, 1910s, into 1920s. The motorized tractors and the diesel combines really showed up following World War I, which ended in 1918. And after that, in the early 20s, the real conversion began. But, you know, one of the interesting things that I found was that even as late as, 1930s, there was a number of farmers that still swore by the horse and, because the horses, believe it or not, were still cheaper. That changed by the 1940s. Basically, everybody had converted to gas or diesel power. It was no longer cheaper to do it with horses. It was cheaper to do it with gasoline. And that also meant that you only needed three, and the manpower costs were vastly lower. You only needed three people to harvest your crop instead of 20.
Interesting, interesting. Was Northwest wheat always primarily exported, or was there a domestic market?
Yeah, there was a domestic market. I mean, I'm sure there still is, but they produced way more wheat than just for the local market. So yes, beginning all the way back in Walla time, when we were talking about Walla Walla in the 1860s, they were sending probably even then most of their crop down to Portland by boat, where it would get on a steamer, and England was one of their main markets, but really all of Europe. They would export their wheat back to Europe. We just had so much acreage and so much land to plant wheat, and Europe didn't, that we could produce wheat cheaper than they could, and they could import it cheaper than they could grow it. So yeah, even back in those days, they were exporting, but that changed in the first half of the 20th century when, first of all, when World War I and World War II really disrupted their ability to export to Europe, but for obvious reasons, there was a gigantic war going on. And World War II affected their ability to export anywhere, really. But by then, they had shifted largely to Asian markets. Most of the wheat was being sent to Asian markets, partly because it was soft white winter wheat, which is perfect for like Japanese noodles and Middle Eastern flatbread and that sort of thing. By the 50s, that conversion was pretty much complete. Most of the wheat was being sent to Asian markets.
Jim, you write a 100 years ago column in the Spokesman Review. Can you create a word picture of how Eastern Washington wheat was being planted, harvested, and marketed a century ago?
So we're talking 1920. Some farmers had already converted to gasoline, but mostly they were still using these gigantic horse or mule powered combines. By this time, the Palouse had really come into its own, partly because of the invention of a thing called a leveler, which, I mean, one of the big problems was the combines would tip over on those steep hillsides. I mean, it's hard to find a flat spot in the Palouse. It's rolling hills, and some of them are pretty steep. But this leveler pretty much solved that problem. It was a huge technological advance, and it really made the Palouse, the harvests on the Palouse possible in a lot of ways. It was clearly now established by 1920 as the premier agricultural crop in eastern Washington. And it was hugely important to the entire state's economy. And by now, the problems of getting it to market were solved by the railroads. They could load it onto railroad cars. But in the 1920s, you still had a lot of the, the old farm culture of lots and lots of farmhands and thriving small towns, with hotels, and, you could go to a place like Harrington, and, the barber shops would all have like baths in the back where the farmhands could come and take a bath and get their hair cut, every Saturday night, go to a dance in the dance hall, and It was a different world, and that changed radically in the next 20 years, with so many fewer people needed to bring the harvest in.
All right. Anything else that you'd like to add here, Jim?
But I think most wheat farmers and wheat people in the wheat industry are very well aware of this, but I'm not sure the average resident of Washington understands that we are supplying. We're feeding the world, really. I think we need to have a little bit of pride in the fact that we are, in fact, feeding the world with this unbelievably good wheat growing conditions that we have here.
Kirshner speaks the truth.
agriculture, including wheat farming, is the most important industry in the world. Can you imagine a world without enough food? And we think COVID is bad. In that respect, I believe it's easily argued that exports of Pacific Northwest soft white wheat to countries around the world is helping keep the peace. But I am, of course, by no means the last word on the subject. History will be the judge. History is always the judge. Speaking of which, you can find out a lot more about Washington's agricultural history at historylink.org, including videos and photographs of an era without air conditioning and with smut explosions. Go to historylink.org, click on Education at the top of the page, and then the curriculum link. Thanks for listening to episode 192, or what I entitled, Wheat's Early Years in Washington, about my conversation with Jim Kirshner, an historian, researcher, and writer on events from Washington's past. Speaking of past, don't forget all those past podcasts you can find at the Washington Grain Commission's new website at wagrains.org. Most are still relevant today. Check them out on the endless scroll. And then, please join me here again next week for another episode of Wheat All About It.
We are all children of a special treat, a miracle of nature that we just call wheat. A crop that's in the Bible, a crop that's in our bread, a crop that's filled our bellies and held us in its head. Through a history of starvation and times of want and woe, wheat has been our savior, our grub, our food, our dough. There's always lots of problems when we have enough to eat, but there's only one dilemma when it's not enough wheat. We feed you.